everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for July 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the Grillmeister, Mr. Timothy Nelson, because I had steaks from Tim Nelson's Grill, and they changed my life.
That's great.
A true story. I came over here, and you need to see how Tim Nelson makes steaks. He just throws them on the grill, pops a lid over them, and forgets about them, basically. And you're like, oh, those steaks. Oh, yeah. And they're the best steaks you've ever had.
It's the it's Applewood smoke, John.
It's outrageous.
I just want to say, if you've never used Applewood smoke chips on your Weber grill,
that's the secret.
That's the key.
And I want to know you guys to know out there that you are all invited to Tim's house for steaks. He said that. So come on over.
Okay. Yeah. Everybody.
So, yes. And I was also over here two nights ago and had some of Tim's famous ribs. And that is when we had the chance to watch one of my favorite movies of all time. It is actually in my top 10 list of all time. And that is the movie we're going to be talking about tonight, which is Do the Right Thing. That is our subject for the evening, Tim. Do the Right Thing.
It's an old movie, John.
It's an old movie, but it's a classic. So, now, right off the bat, I do want to give a little bit of a disclaimer here. I know you can't see us, but Tim and I are both white, and we
Wait a minute. I know.
And we're going to be discussing some issues that I think are really important to the black community, and that's something that we are very sensitive about, and we struggle with a bit of it, because neither of us would ever claim to know what it's truly like to be a black person in America. And there's going to be times tonight where we may say something that, if you're a person of color, may sound naive or ignorant. And if so, I do apologize. It's not intentional. We admit that we have not walked in your shoes, and we just ask you for grace. And we even debated before about doing this movie. You know, are we doing the right thing? That's what we said to each other. But ultimately, we wanted to move forward because we are a movie podcast, first and foremost, and this is one of the best movies of all time, and we want to talk about it because of that, and you can't talk about it unless you talk about all the themes that are present, and so we will be hitting on those. So please give us grace.
I think the bigger thing here is, like I was thinking a little bit about this, is that I think art speaks truth. It speaks truth to power. I think it speaks truth to us in ways that other things can't, and I think film is one of those ways that art does that. Film is art. Good
yep.
film.
Right.
And I think what we're looking at here is art that speaks truth. And so that's kind of where we're starting out here. I've had some powerful dialogues around this film with people, all kinds of different people. And I think this is art that is speaking truth into very broken into a lot of brokenness. And so it's particularly appropriate right now to be talking about this film. And I think this film takes us to a place that sometimes we can't get on social media. And it does, it kind of functions in some ways like the way Jesus was doing, told parables. It functions in ways where it exposes us that make us uncomfortable. And that's what good art does. It asks us to change. And so as we come into this, I think we come into it, we're white guys, that's true, but I think we come into it with a deep respect for art, and we see this as a pretty amazing work of art.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. So Do the Right Thing. This is a film directed by the legendary Spike Lee, and I'm sure all of you have heard that name. He is, I would assume, a household name. He's made a ton of films. Man, is this a prolific filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many, but too many for me to watch. I've only seen about half of them, I would say, maybe. That's probably being generous.
Because he's like directed or produced, I think, over 35.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and this one, the ironic thing is that Do the Right Thing was, I think, his like third or fourth film. When he was just getting started out, he was super young, super green, and it's still, in my opinion, his best work that he has yet to top, and this was like early in his career. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think everyone agrees with that. Yes. There's not a whole lot of debate about whether this is his best film. Yep. He's had, a lot of people will say he's had some films that have mixed reviews, mm-hmm. and that there's strong points in other films, but this film is strong throughout.
Absolutely. And I'll never forget the first time I watched this, because it starts off like the credits come up and you have this beautiful jazz music, right? That's just kind of contemplative and meditating, and it's just really beautiful. And then all of a sudden it cuts to Public Enemy's
Fight the Power,
and to this woman dancing in the street. And I just knew there was something in my mind, like within the first like minute, I knew I was about to watch a masterpiece. Like, it just, I knew everything was going to work in this movie, and it proved true. The opening is incredible. Just this woman dancing, and she is not just dancing, but it's protest dancing, and mm-hmm. yet it's beautiful and ballet, and it's amazing. I love it.
I think like it's almost one of the things that you and I talk about a lot, and is that usually the first scene in the film summarizes the film.
Yeah, right.
And so what I saw in that first scene is you have this kind of beautiful jazz, which is obviously like that's like one of the biggest contributions, a unique art form with it of, you know, in Black America created jazz.
Yeah.
Okay. It didn't come from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. That's a uniquely Black American. Out of the Black experience, you get jazz. Mm-hmm. And so you start out there, and then you get go to straight to hip hop, which is also the same way, right?
Yep.
And then the dancing that Rosie Perez is doing is like a violent, almost like a protest.
Yeah. She even got boxing gloves on at one point.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And it's like violent in some ways, beautiful while it's violent.
Yeah. Right.
And I think that's kind of like a summary of the film in some ways, is that it's this beautiful protest. There's parts of it that are violent. Sometimes you feel uncomfortable even watching Rosie Perez dance.
Yeah. Right.
But the idea is like, you can't ignore it. Yeah. It's like in your face, just like we talk about, I think we talk over and over about Kubrick and Clockwork Orange, like the first scene is in your face. Mm-hmm. And when you, the same way, like what you just described, John, it's like when you saw that Clockwork Orange, you're like, oh my gosh,
that slow pullback. Yeah.
It's just so in your face. I felt the same way about Rosie Perez and in that first scene. Mm-hmm. So it's like kind of brilliant.
And then we cut from that to Samuel L. Jackson, a young Samuel L. Jackson. He must have been in his 20s, I'm assuming.
No, I don't
you don't think so.
I don't think that young.
All right.
He's old.
Maybe a little bit older. But Samuel Jackson, he's a DJ in this radio station, and he's this guy who like pumps music to everyone's radios all throughout the day, and he also gives a weather forecast, and he says right off the bat that today is going to be hot. Yes. Which really sets the tone of this movie, because the heat becomes this sort of metaphor for, it's like this boiling pot of water on the stove, you know, as we go on throughout this day. The movie takes place over a day and a night, and as we go on through this water just keeps getting hotter and hotter as we see these people getting hotter and hotter. Every scene they're sweating, that you can almost feel the steam rising off the streets, right? And then it's boiling to this climax, which takes place at the end. So the heat is kind of this unspoken element that really sets the tone for the movie.
So he does that in another movie too.
Which one?
It's the one, now I'm forgetting the name of it. It's about Son of Sam.
Okay, Son of Sam.
I mean, that actually occurred. Like, there was a heat wave at that point.
Yeah.
But like, this idea of a heat wave is like that's been repeated in several films.
And you said something about the sets.
Or Summer of Sam. Yeah.
They purposely painted the sets to accentuate the heat, or to
so
make
like
it seem-
oranges and reds, and they wanted to make it look hotter, like look hot. Like that was the whole key to everything.
And it does.
And so it does. You feel hot watching the movie, which is really weird. You're like, oh man, it's hot.
Yeah.
And you're like,
wait
a minute, it's January in Wisconsin. but no, you feel hot watching it, and he's going for that effect. Mm-hmm. The lighting feels like a hot day. I don't know how to explain that, but you can feel it like in the pizza shop. You can feel it. Like, man, it's hot out in here. And you're like, well, how do we know that? And the characters, a lot of sweating. People are outside. And it's like because the heat basically is driving people outside together. Mm-hmm. So they've, and all kinds of different people.
Yes.
So it's like they're all under the sun.
And that's what I love about this movie is it presents the city in all of its diversity and all of the characters within it. You know, one thing that you and I can, I think, both relate to somewhat from firsthand experience is that we moved from a suburban environment to the inner city. And we're currently living in the inner city in predominantly Black neighborhoods. And one of the first thing I noticed when I came here from the suburbs was how the Black community understands community. Like, they really do. Like, my neighbors will sit on their porch for hours talking to each other. And that is something you cannot find in the suburbs. I mean, like, you're talking like the suburbs, you get a 5-minute talk, maybe. How are you? Good. How are you? Great. Right, bolt that door.
I'm going to go into my basement and play video games for 7 hours now.
Right. Yeah. But instead, they're outside and they're talking, and that's beautiful. Yeah.
Well, I think it depends where you're at. I think that's city life, and not just the Black community, but I think it's city life anywhere you're at, where you have high density,
right?
And then especially, like, I'm thinking about here, it's like air conditioning. So if you don't have air conditioning, you're gonna be outside, and so you're seeing like. All the characters are hanging out, trying to keep cool, grabbing a beer. Yeah.
In this movie, that's right. They're all outside. They're all talking to each other. And we see so many different characters. And it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And there's a sense of community, which everybody knows everybody. And they're always they run into each other a whole bunch of times every day.
Mm-hmm.
And
everybody knows each other's names. Right, exactly.
So it's kind of a unique perspective that I really, you don't see that in film very often. Like, you don't look at a neighborhood like... Lee is like, he's got to be writing out of his own experience. It is out of his own experience.
Yeah.
Because he's lived in that neighborhood. And so he's writing this, and he sees the community as like kind of like more of a composite or like an organic, like a system on its own. Rather than like we tend to look at film as an individual's experience. And we look at it like in a very Western way. Like, we have to have a protagonist who goes through these things. And you have some of that within this film, but really it's like about a community.
Yeah.
Which is like a really cool perspective.
Yes. Yeah, I can't think of many movies that depict the city and all of its ups and downs better than this one. I really can't. And one of the other staples of any urban environment is the restaurants and the shops around you. You know, I've got like the best Chinese shop ever around the corner from my house. Like, it beats anything that I've ever had in the suburbs. And one shop that we're introduced to right away in the film is Sal's Famous Pizzeria.
Sal's. Everybody loves Sal's.
This is a pizza shop right in the middle of the city, and it is run by a father and his two sons. And Sal is the father. And so we're introduced to this family right away. And the first thing you notice about this family is that the sons, specifically one that you probably will recognize, his name's John Turturro. He is Jesus in The Good Big Lebowski.
He's got other roles, too.
He has other roles. But that's
the creepiest.
The guy with the bowling ball. Anyway. So his name is Pino. And he hates working at this pizza shop. He just hates being in this city environment. He hates it. And so right away, you have this argument about who's going to sweep the sidewalk. And he's just like, I hate this place. And so you have this family. But Sal, the interesting thing about him is he loves this shop. And he built it with his bare hands. He's had it for about 20 years. He's seen people literally grow up eating his food. And he takes pride in that. And he loves the community. He loves the people in the community. One of the first things you see of Sal is this character named DeMayer walks into the pizza shop and asks if he's got any work today. And Sal gives him a broom and says, yeah, you can go sweep. And he gives him money. And you know, Pina's like, why do you do this?
Which his own sons are refusing to do that.
Exactly. And his own sons argue
about
it.
Nobody wants to do it.
Right. And so this is Sal. He's been here for 25 years. He loves this community, and we're introduced to him right away. And the other person who works at this shop is a guy by the name of Mookie. And Mookie is played by none other than Spike Lee himself. And Mookie is basically our protagonist for the story, though you could argue that the city is almost the protagonist because it's just there's so many different perspectives we're introduced to. But Mookie is kind of like our filter that we see the cities through his eyes. And he works at this pizza shop. He's like the delivery guy for the whole neighborhood. So he's always out and about delivering pizzas, and that's how we get to see everyone around town. And there's just so many great characters in this movie. Like, DeMayer is the one we talked about. He's kind of like the drunken bum of the town. There's Mother Sister, who's sort of like this elder figure in the city. There's all these kids and teenagers, a young Martin Lawrence.
There's actually like three budding comedians that were like in this movie as like, they're not in minor roles, but they're not like major roles. And so I don't know what you call it, medium role. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they're in a bunch of different scenes, and so this movie's full of comedians, but they're not actually acting in a comedic roles.
Hmm.
So they end up becoming really famous later on. But yeah, Martin Lawrence is one of them.
Martin Lawrence. Yep. There's a mentally challenged guy named Smiley who goes around the city all day with this picture of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, and he's handing out these pamphlets, and everyone's kind of annoyed with him, but he's like always there, and so they put up with him, and just so many different characters. The city's just alive with people, and I love it. Who's your favorite character in the movie?
Oh, me?
Yeah. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Gosh, I probably, you know, I like the Mookie character.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I know that's like so an easy answer, but I probably feel the same way.
I do. I think he's, because he's so kind of tortured and pulled.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. You mentioned, because we had a chance to watch this movie again today, or not today, but recently, you had mentioned that Mookie has to constantly change his identity depending on who he's talking to. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
He's like always code switching, and he's like has to cross all the boundaries all the time. So he's kind of like bears the weight of everything that's broken.
Hmm.
And so like, and so from all the way, like, so he's like a boundary crosser within the movie. So he works for the Italian, you know, he works for Sal.
Yep.
And then, but he's also willing to kind of speak to the brothers because Totoro is like super racist and kind of abusive to his younger brother.
Yeah.
And he's willing to talk about that. So he's willing to enter into that. But I think the stuff I see is like code switching.
What do you mean by that? Can you explain?
So basically he has to change like how he relates. It's like having two like different languages for different people that you're with. And then he has to, when he's at work, he has to be a certain way. And then when he's outside of work, he can be a different way. And if he's relating with other black folks, he can be one way. When he's relating to his mother-in-law, who's Puerto Rican, and he has to be a different way.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's a totally... He's constantly bearing the weight of having to change all the time.
And this is something that white people don't have to do a lot. I mean, Right. Would you say that?
Like, at all.
Ever. Yeah.
And so, basically, Mookie looks tired, like, through the whole movie.
He does.
Because he has to do things like... One of his best friends is this guy bugging out, mm-hmm. and he has to kick bugging out of the pizza restaurant, and then he goes to go outside and go, look, hey, this is, you know what, you're I forgot what his words were, but he's like, you're messing me up here. And so he has to find ways to, like, basically kick his best friend out of the restaurant,
yeah.
and then still, but also, like, you know, keep his job.
With
and
Sam,
then he
yeah.
has to, like, make his, he has to make Rosie Perez, who's the mother of his son, like, he has to keep her kind of happy. And so there's a bunch of stuff. So basically it's like all this weight is on him, hmm. like all the time. Mm-hmm. And he, like, his actual identity is like, you know, it's like, well, what is it? And so yeah. I think, like, you really get a sense in this film of like a deep, like this deep burden of, and I would say that he's probably emblematic, and I don't want to like speak for Spike Lee, but I'm just guessing, like, he is the black male experience, which is the idea of, like, you're constantly to survive, you're constantly code switching,
yeah,
and that you're constantly bearing a burden that other people don't necessarily have to bear, and it's just like he looks worn out, and even in the scene, like in a lot of scenes, he's on the curb with his hands on his head.
You're right.
And it's just like, and he's always trying to do the right thing throughout the whole movie. Mm-hmm. And when you're in this environment where you have all these different identities, doing the right thing is like really, like, it's almost like impossible.
So you mentioned one of the central conflicts of the film that kind of forms the climax at the end, where this character named Buggin' Out, he loves Sal's, but he's eating his pizza, and he notices that Sal has this, like, wall of fame with all these pictures of white Italian Americans. So you have Michael Corleone and Robert De Niro's Raging Bull and, you know, all these, like, white people on the wall, and Buggin' Out's like, why don't you have any brothers on the wall? Like, right?
Well, they're all Italians.
They're all Italians, right.
So, you know, 100 years ago or 80 years ago, they were a persecuted group in the same neighborhood.
Ah.
And so the idea being, like, he has all these Italians up because the idea is like, well, I got to have some pride in my people. And so these are famous Italians, and they would have been, and not comparing this to the black experience, but I'm saying we would be considered like a group that would be lower than another group and would have been considered, Yeah, they would have, people would have been very prejudiced against Italians.
That's interesting.
At a certain time period. And so he has all these things to go, here, look, at Italians are great. Check it out.
Yeah,
so he has
yeah.
a wall, basically, to show, hey, Italians are wonderful, and here's some Italians that you would know. And so it's kind of like a point of pride for Sal.
Yeah, which is why he gets so offended, because when Bugging Out mentions this, he basically kicks him out of the shop and says, you are banned from Sal's. And that leads Bugging Out to start this mission to boycott.
The boycott.
Sal's Famous. Leading a boycott of Sal's Famous. And so this is kind of the central conflict that comes back later on. And it's an interesting debate. I mean, I see where Bugging Out's coming from, because, you know, he says, we give you much money. Like, I mean, basically, the African Americans are supporting Sal's business, and he needs to recognize that he's in a black community, right? I mean, you see where he's coming from, but at the same time, I get what you're saying, is that it's Sal saying, this is my shop. You can create your own shop someday and have brothers on the wall, but this is an Italian shop. I want to respect that heritage. So I don't know. It's an interesting debate to me, but
so that's interesting. So that's interesting. I don't know what Spike Lee is asking us to draw from that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. Yeah.
So, and you see these subtle racial tensions kind of bubbling here, and this, as you mentioned, Pino, which is John Turturro, he is basically openly racist. I think he's probably, throughout the film, one of the most just openly racist characters. And he has this really fascinating conversation with Mookie that I love, where Mookie basically, he pulls him aside and he calls him on this idea that he basically asks him, who's your favorite basketball player? You know, Michael Jordan. You know, who's your favorite athlete? And all the heroes that Pino has in his life are black. But Pino says, Yeah, but see, those people aren't really black. They're more than black. It's different. That's what he says. I think that's a really interesting line, because it kind of gets to the heart of kind of the racial tension we see around us today, right? Like, very few white people have a problem with, say, Denzel Washington. You know, there's something, I don't know exactly how to explain that, but there's something, for some reason, white people have different differentiations of black people in their mind, and you know, there's these kinds and then there's other kinds. And then right after this scene, Spike Lee cuts to this montage of all these different people hurling racial insults directly at the camera of like every race depicted in the film. So black people, white people, Asians, and everybody in the film. And so it's really interesting. It's just, to me, I don't know, my takeaway, and I want to get yours too, but is that this idea that Pino is just, he's so condescending when he's talking to Mookie, and I think this is like gets to the heart of why we're still struggling with racism, is because, you know, when you get to the Black Lives Matter movement and things, is white people, like, they think they've got this thing figured out. There's no racism in America today, you know, and they're just like, and they're saying that to black people. And how it's so lunacy to me that white people would be claimed to have the definitive knowledge of whether racism exists in America, and yet that's what they do. They this conversation that we see between Pino and Mookie plays out in 2016 just as much as it did then, you know?
Yeah, I think that, like, I look at that conversation a little bit, like, I know you're kind of like using that as like a launching pad for other thoughts. I look at that conversation as being just kind of pointing out the kind of duplicitous, like, this admiration for individuals, but like a disdain for a group of people, which is like super weird to me.
That is.
But I look at one of the things I've drawn after watching this movie several times is the idea that Sal's American dream is a direct threat to his community. And so it's like this idea of like, okay, if I work real hard and I do a really, you know, and I get this business going, and you know, and then my sons can inherit this. And he has this very individualistic work hard, Protestant work ethic kind of version that white people love that. I love that. Right.
Yeah, right.
And what's funny is that can be so powerful that it can blind us to what's actually happening around us. And that's exactly what happens in the film. And so I don't want to give away the ending or anything.
Well, we're getting there.
But the idea being, this movie is not about a pizzeria. This movie's about police violence. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And every reference, there's reference after reference after reference to police violence. What's funny is a lot of white folks, including you, John, right now,
yes, I know,
think it's about a pizzeria and about Sal's American dream, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But the movie's actually about police violence. And what's funny is that we get so drawn into the American Dream story that it's very easy to forget. And I think Lee's messing with white folks in this movie.
That's good.
And he's, you know, and he's contrasting, you know, he's like, well, maybe this isn't what it's about. I think what's really interesting to me is if you contrast Sal and Demare. Because Sal's making people pay an extra 50 cents to add cheese to their pizza. Mm-hmm. He's always assuming somebody's trying to get him. And he's like, you know, and the mayor has nothing. He's a drunk.
Yeah.
And he's always giving extra money to people, buying flowers for people. He's like this like model of generosity.
Yeah.
And Sal is not.
Yeah. No, he's not.
At all.
He's capitalism at its
finest. At all. He's like, hey, we had a great day. We took home this money. Uh-huh. And yeah. And so that's like really interesting. So that's one thing that I've really picked up is this idea of that. Perhaps our idea of the American dream, the white idea of American dream, could be a direct threat to reconciliation, and personally, for me, to the gospel.
Well, let's go right into that ending that you're talking about, because I know our time is short, and I want to, and there's so much to talk about in the ending. So we're going to talk about this. Now, if you haven't seen Do the Right Thing, we're going to spoil it a little
bit.
You've
only had 27 years to watch this movie.
Literally, 27 years. Go ahead, just keep listening, and you'll still enjoy the movie, we promise.
I've seen it like probably 6 times.
Yes.
I mean, my the barber shop in our neighborhood, I asked the guy, he's like a big film guy, what's your favorite film? And he's like, he thought for a couple of seconds, he's like, oh yeah, Do the Right Thing. That was his favorite movie. So I was like, I got to watch this again. And then I haven't really stopped watching it for 3 years now.
Yep.
I watch it probably about every 6 months.
Every single time you watch it, there's more layers to it. So we're not spoiling anything for you. But in the ending, basically, the ending centers around this character named Radio Raheem. Now, Radio Raheem is this guy who walks around with this big boombox, and he's listening to Public Enemy's Fight the Power all day.
It's like, all he listens to.
The only song he listens to. And he's very respected among this community because he's no nonsense. There's something that people respect about him. And there's this amazing scene that he has with Mookie where he wears these like gold brass knuckles that say on one hand it says love, and on the other hand it says hate. And he has this awesome scene where he's talking about how love and hate battle each other, but love wins in the end. And you had mentioned when we watched it how close he looks to Muhammad Ali.
He doesn't look just like Muhammad Ali, but he does a lot of this boxing scene.
Yeah, that's exactly
and
right.
He does look like Muhammad Ali. He's a bigger guy,
right?
But I think he is evoking some of that idea of like he is unashamed truth that's speaking power.
And I didn't realize how big of a deal Muhammad Ali was to the black community until he died and I heard these interviews. But that's exactly what kept coming up again and again in those interviews.
He's not afraid.
Yep.
He's strong. He's gonna stand up for what he believes. But he also is like loving.
He is, yeah.
And you're like, whoa. yeah. So and he believes that love is powerful.
Yep.
More powerful than hate.
Yeah. And so he's got this boombox, and the conflict emerges because every time he goes into Sal's, Sal wants him to turn off his radio. And he basically gets to the point where he hooks up with Buggin' Out, who's on this boycott of Sal's, and they basically go in to teach Sal, you know, or just to take it to Sal and say, we're not going to put up with this anymore. So they go in there. This is after hours. Sal's let a few people in because he's in a really good mood. So the shop is kind of open past when it's supposed to be. And here comes Buggin' Out, who's mad about the pictures, and Radio Raheem blaring his radio, and Sal says, turn off that radio. And instantly, you know, this is not going to go down well. And what happens is Sal takes out a baseball bat and destroys Radio Raheem's radio. He's Radio Raheem. This is more than a radio. This is his identity, right? And everybody looks at each other, and then all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose. Radio Raheem gets into a fight with Sal. He's basically choking him out. They stumble onto the street, and everybody's surrounding them, this epic fight. And then the police show up, and that's when things get really bad because the police pull Radio Raheem off of him. But in the process, they're so rough with him that they end up actually choking him out and killing Radio Raheem right there on the spot.
With a nightstick, they choke him out.
With
a
nightstick.
They hold him up.
And
so it's like very blatant. You can watch it.
Yeah.
You know.
And everybody sees this. They know exactly what happened. The police look around and go, oh my gosh, we're in serious trouble. We got to get out of here. And they unceremoniously just shove him in a car and drive away. And then all of a sudden there's this riot in the streets. And then what we see is Mookie in his famous hands over his face, doesn't know what to do. He takes a garbage can and he smashes Sal's window of his shop. And that turns the focus to Sal's pizzeria, and they rush in and they burn it to the ground. And that is the...
Not to the ground.
Well, they burn
to
it.
A hole.
To a nice. Yeah.
So what... Can I back up a little?
Go ahead, please.
So I think, like, radio... There's this whole thing of, like, competing loudness that goes on in the movie.
Competing loudness. Okay.
So there's different music. So you have... The Puerto Rican dudes have their music, and they have a boombox, and it's pretty loud. And so, like, they kind of have the control of, like, what everybody in the neighborhood hears. And then Radio Raheem comes in, and he's got the biggest boombox. Mm-hmm. And so he comes in, and he like basically battles those guys, and he wins. And so because his boombox is so loud, it's fight the power. Mm-hmm. He can do it. And then he goes into Sal's. And Sal is saying, no, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear this. This is too loud. I can't even hear myself.
Yep.
And eventually it becomes so bad that he smashes his radio. And I think that, like, that idea has everything to do with the contemporary kind of thing, which is, I think, the white response to this idea is fight the power. He's basically saying, like, the story... That Public Enemy is basically saying all our heroes maybe weren't heroes,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they do a little bit stronger language than that.
Yeah.
But John Wayne, Elvis, all these people that, like, are these white heroes are actually horrible racists,
mm-hmm.
and they're pretty terrible dudes. And we need to fight this evil power because this thing that's in power is not just, it's evil. And some of the things that we revere, these institutions we revere, actually might be the place where the most evil lies.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that, so that's a metaphor, right?
Yeah.
And that Sal would smash that voice and, like, totally destroy that voice so that he could hear himself think. To me, like, told that artistic idea that Lee is drawing in that.
What a powerful metaphor.
It's very powerful. Now, the third thing that I think with this, like, competition of, like, loudness mm-hmm. would be who's the character, the guy that has the Malcolm X and Martin Luther King?
Smiley.
Smiley has the tiniest boombox in the universe around his neck. It's a tape deck.
You're right.
And, like, the small...
You barely notice it.
You don't notice it. It's like a tape deck, and it's like a tiny thing, and you can't even hear it during the movie. And that's, like, the smallest boombox. It's the smallest voice, and it's this voice of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And no, and it's, like, completely irrelevant. Nobody ever talks about it. It's just irritating to almost everyone. And they're like, once in a while, they'll go, all right, I'll give it a couple bucks.
Uh-huh.
But it's not relevant.
Yeah.
In the film. And so I think, like, those the competitions of those different voices, which is kind of interesting because it's almost like you can tell there's a reverence for King and there's a reverence for X in the movie. I mean, that's, like, very clear.
Oh, absolutely. And it ends with a picture of them, in fact.
But the Smiley character shows, in some ways, that it's viewed as irrelevant.
Or garbled, I mean, his message, because he's mentally handicapped.
Right, yeah. So he can't even, like, get the message out.
Exactly.
Like, it's like he can't quite do it. He's got this tiny boombox that's not allowing it to be loud enough, and it's getting kind of swallowed up by everybody else's noise.
Yeah.
But I think the idea is, and I think Black Lives Matter kind of hits this, is that the civil rights stuff, that movement is a little bit irrelevant in some ways. It didn't accomplish what was supposed to accomplish.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think Lee is saying that, but I think that character of Smiley kind of connotes it a little bit.
Sure.
So I think that's a very interesting thing. That character was added, like, later on. Huh. It wasn't a part of the original script.
He
wasn't
know.
The actual character. Like, asked, he's like, you gotta add this. You gotta add this character in.
Wow.
Yeah. That's but awesome. In any case, and everyone's kind of like, all right. Here's a couple bucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't, like, really. Smiley's not necessarily shaping the lives or shaping the community.
Now, you mentioned police violence. This is definitely clearly seen in the end here, and this is something that's very relevant today. In July, we had these horrible incidents that took place with Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. And we, for the first time, it feels like we, with these cell phone videos, we were actually there. You know, we saw this firsthand perspective of what
I think it's white people when you say we.
Yeah, when I say we, it's exactly what I mean. Yeah. For the first time, we're in it, and I think it woke a lot of people up, as it should. And, you know, even recently, there was Freddie Gray. All of the officers acquitted in the Freddie Gray trial, this man who it was put into the back of a police car, completely conscious and full-bodied, and came out with his spine severed and unconscious, and everybody walks away. Not just walks away, but actually with a paid vacation because they got retroactive pay for their entire trial. And people say that's injustice, and I would tend to agree with them. But we see this in the movie, these police officers, and look, no one's arguing that these police officers wake up and they just want to kill someone today. They're scared. And they walk in this movie, they walk into this situation that is horrifying, and it's madness all around them, and they're freaked out, and they go too far.
Well,
but
I don't know about that.
What do you mean?
I don't know. I think you might be reading into it. They don't seem afraid to me in the movie.
Really?
They seem in control.
Now, maybe I'm thinking of after they've gone too far and they've killed Radio Raheem, they definitely are panicked at that point.
I think they're panicked to cover their tracks.
Right.
I don't think they're
afraid. You
don't
think they're scared when they go into the situation?
No, and you get a little bit of that in the fire hydrant scene, where before is basically like they're in control. They're in control of the citizens. Mm-hmm. They're in control of everybody. So they're in control of the Italian folks. They're in control of the African-American folks. They're in control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm saying this is what Spike Lee said,
right,
not necessarily what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And the idea is that they can do whatever they want. And if they want to come after you, can. And if they want to, you know, let you go, they can. But they can do whatever they want with you.
Hmm.
And so I think that's interesting. And then I'd also say, like, it's a very, it is anti-police. I mean, that's like what the movie is.
Right. The police are depicted in that way. That's jerks in power, sort of. Right.
Yeah. And I would say, like, you know, with all the allusions to police violence, like all these victims of police violence are alluded to throughout the movie.
And in the credits.
Like real people in New York
who
experienced, you know, were murdered or experienced or beaten or, you know, that's name after name after name within that movie. Wikipedia all those names and you'll see. But the idea is, like, this movie is about police violence.
Yep.
And that we would be willing to overlook it is, like, the biggest thing I see in the film.
Well, let's go there, because this cuts to the heart of this. When Mookie takes his trash can and smashes Sal's window. Now, first of all, I want to ask up front, did Mookie do the right thing, Tim?
So what Spike Lee would say is, he said only white people would ask that question. So there you are.
Okay. I guess that's
true. And I'm not saying that like in a judgment way. I think he would be saying that in probably in a rightfully judgmental way.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, righteously judgmental way.
Righteous. Yeah. You've missed the point if you ask the question.
Yep.
And the idea being that, so we look at the movie and we're like, do the right thing. Oh, this must be about Mookie throwing a trash can through a window of a store.
Mind you, this is after Radio Raheem has been killed by police that this happens.
Right. So Radio Raheem is basically, he's choked to death by police.
Yep.
And the crowd is really upset with Sal and his sons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, we're going to, you know, what are you going to do? What are we going to do now? And it sounds like you got to do what you got to do.
And you could argue that Mookie's saving their life by doing what he did, because they might have killed them.
Well, yeah. You could argue that. I think clearly, like, that's what I think was happening there, is that Mookie basically saved Sal's life.
Yeah.
But
the interesting part is that you're right, and this was totally the first viewing. I was upset, very upset about Sal's store getting burned down. This really irked me that this happened, and I honestly, and I'm ashamed to admit this, but I completely forgot on my first viewing that Radio Raheem had even died, and I was, I did, and I was just so upset about Sal's pizza shop being destroyed.
Because the crowd attacks the American dream.
Yeah.
So, like, this is, like, part of my recent thinking on this is, like, Sal is a small business owner who works really hard, and he's brought his sons in the business, and he's living out this American dream just to eke out a little bit of a living, right? And he's in this community, and he's, like, committed to him, even though, like, he's not the same demographics, and culturally everything's different, and some people don't exactly like him, but a lot of people do. And so he's kind of a likable entrepreneur who believes in hard work.
Yep.
And so when somebody throws
we've been trained
a
to love
trash
that.
Can through his glass window, we asked, did they do the right thing? Because it's assault. Because that's like, oh, you're assaulting my values. But when somebody murders Radio Raheem,
yeah,
we didn't question that.
We didn't question it. We moved right along to the next thing.
Well, I say we, meaning most of the white folks that have watched the movie. And I've watched the movie with groups before. Yep.
And so which is more important? Is it a man's life or property damage? What? And that...
Well, I think Spike Lee would say that the... this is actually what he would say, because I've read some of the interviews, that he would actually say black men are actually viewed as property.
Oof.
By white folks.
Wow.
And so he would say the death of Radio Raheem and this destruction of a plate glass window for white folks are... which one's more valuable to you?
Yeah.
Human life or property?
Yeah.
So that's interesting to me. And I think that question comes up into, you know, when we're talking about a lot of this, the dynamics of this, of, kind of the debates that are going on right now, and I'm not going to get too into that, but this is, you know, is when people are protesting or they're taking things out on property in response to someone's life being taken, they tend to be condemned, and we don't think about like there was a life taken. What I like about Spike Lee's film is he's not telling us what to think.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's like really strong. That's so it's good. Good art is that way too.
That takes discipline, right?
It's a discipline thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's building a case, but he's allowing us to kind of enter into this story.
Yeah.
And we make the judgment. And at some point, we make the judgment on ourselves. So when we go, you know, on the first time you watch this, you're like, oh man, why did Mookie do that? I liked Mookie. He was a good guy.
right.
And then you take a little bit more reflection. You go, wait a minute, maybe Mookie is a good guy. And maybe I've got some kind of warped, screwed up values.
Yeah.
Exactly. I like art because if we're honest with the art, it allows us to look at ourselves. Rather than get into a debate with other people about the, you know, merits of our position, but it allows us to enter into that story and then go, wait a minute, maybe I was wrong about this. And I feel like this movie does that.
Yeah.
You know, I think about David and Nathan, right? So the prophet David had, you know, basically done some horrible, abusive, sinful things.
Yeah.
He had murdered a guy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he's... And Nathan tells him a parable.
Tells him a story.
Yeah, he tells him a story, and then David enters into that story.
He goes ballistic.
About a man and a sheep, and he said, you know, this guy this guy should be killed. And he's like, you are that man. And he convicts him of his sin. And what I would hope this movie does is it puts us in that position as white folks. And not that we would not just like to get white guilt out of us, but it would put us in a position of beginning to see some of our blindness and beginning to go, wow, I've got some pretty major sin when it comes to how I view the world that needs to be dealt with. And I think this movie is capable of doing that in a way that I haven't seen. Some other films can do too, but this one is weird. It's 27 years old, but it's so relevant.
So relevant.
Yeah.
So if you had to sum up your review of the movie, give a 1 minute review, closing, what are your thoughts on Do the Right Thing?
It's a beautiful movie. So it shows beauty. It's balanced. And I think here's what I was, sorry, I'm not doing 30 seconds. I don't know. I think what we want, which is the movie that won Best Picture the year that Do the Right Thing came out and didn't get nominated, was Driving Miss Daisy.
Wow.
I think we want the black chauffeur Morgan Freeman character. I think that's what white America wants.
Yep.
And I think what Spike Lee offers us is is a different vision that is full of life and respect, love and power and a place at the table. And it's more real. And I think that's the choice. I think this movie, are you going to keep the Driving Miss Daisy, or are you going to try to understand Mookie and the community of Bed-Stuy, you know?
It's wonderful, man. For me, I think it's an absolute classic. There's no question. And like you said, it's so timeless. 27 years ago, and this speaks to the events that we've all gone through this month more than any other movie I could possibly think of, and that's amazing. It's not dated a second. It just exposes us to the reality of racism and injustice, and to me, it's a perfect film, and I don't think Spike Lee's ever going to top it. So I give it an A+. This is the plus category for me, and it's a classic, and that's it. That's Do the Right Thing. And I think, like you said, I think what we hope about this whole discussion is just that, as if you're a person of a white person listening to this, that what Tim said, that we'll just listen more. I think the central problem that I feel like we've run into as these events have unfolded is just the inability to listen to another person's perspective without jumping to conclusions, and that's what I hope that we will do more of, and we'll just listen to the pain and the struggles and the stories. And if you haven't seen this film, I just really hope you'll see it, because it is the film for our time. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think it should have won the Academy Award, honestly.
Oh, no kidding.
I really do. For 89, I really do.
No question.
Yeah, you could make it again today, and it, you know, the context would be slightly different. It'd be looked differently, but yeah, I think it's a beautiful film. It's a painful film, and I feel like I would encourage anyone, you know, everyone to watch it if they haven't seen it. Watch it and watch it again.
Thank you so much, Tim, as always, for joining me. It was a great discussion, and keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.
Yeah,
you love that.